Dr. Levin.
Okay, well, it's a pleasure to be here, and I think I have far more material than the time will allow, so I'll go fairly rapidly and basically have some background which relates to marginalization in general, and then look at some of the specifics about the war, essentially in the 80s and 90s in the mountains, and then we'll, in Q&A and other times, we'll look at the some of the current situations. Carry on. That's who I am. And I have copies of the newsletter if you would like to look at it. So Nuba Mountains, in case somebody is wondering where they are, they're in the southern part of Kordofan, so the southern part of the north and the northern part of the south in the huge Sudan. And the size is not just a basic fact, it's really important because of how easily people can get marginalized because the territory is so vast. And it with complicated climates and microclimates in the Nuba Mountains because of the hills that we'll see in a few images. Now, in the middle of Nuba Mountains is exactly why people went there in the first place. Probably Nuba, not to be confused with Nubian, because it's somehow linked, also linguistically and historically, but also quite separate. They must have been far more extensive in all of Sudan. Maybe even they were the Sea Group people in ancient times. I am very fascinated and work in archaeology, so we can pursue that too. But in any case, over many centuries, the people, which we can call Nuban or Nubian in general, retreated to the remote areas of Sudan to avoid the problem. So even you find here, with that blue dot, was where Nuba Mountains, but in fact someone would call it Nubia to complicate it more. Or where did Nubia go? Because over here, you'll see, maybe the lights are down, it might help a little bit. It says Nubia, and it was only Sudan basically a century ago, Anglo-Egyptian Sudan, and Sudan was over here Balad Sudan. So the names are moving all around, and it has to be very clear which one is which and at which particular time. Is it possible to make the lights lower so that this comes up a little bit better? Anyway, here's a modern map of the area, and you can see that the Nuba Mountains, right identified here, is officially part of the north because it's in Kordofan. But essentially, it has cultural and linguistic and ecological affiliations with the Nilotic people, particularly Nuer and Dinka, to the south. So that's part of the marginalization. It's marginalized between two cultural spheres. So this is what the Nuba Mountains look like if you were flying over, with little small hill villages here and there, which we'll take a quick look at. Here's a map of Darnuba. And the principal towns. I'm sure you can find your town. I have been there, but a long time ago, so before the war, actually. So I have archaic references and then very up-to-date, information. Linguistically, a very complicated place because this Nuba Mountains area has scores of different groups or subgroups with different languages which have a rough familiarity, but not necessarily mutual intelligibility. So that's another topic to talk about. Or in this kind of map, if we think of colonialism from the Berlin Congress of 1884 and 85, that map almost has no relevance to Africa on the ground in terms of this would really be a map of Sudan if Sudanese and the ethnic groups that compose the Sudan would be part of it. So, again, anthropology, I think I don't have time for it. But anyway, we find there's a great deal of wealth of linguistic information for these particular people whose very existence came from their marginalization, but their own self-actualized marginalization to escape predations of Arab slavers. Anthropologist, basic information. I will just let you kind of read along because they're short. Non-Arab, non-Muslim patterns of marriage, basically. Likewise, family has some sort of similarities, but these are not Arab people by any means. And even on the cousin terminology, basic anthropological fact, Arabs have very classical type of cousin terminology, not found for Nuba Mountains. So if you were to go over there, here's some of the hills in the background and the famous, you know, Tabeldi trees. They have African architecture, conical roofs, round houses, not Arab architectures, flat roofs and square houses. So we're dealing with a different cultural, you know, domain. Agricultural people, they can have rain-fed agriculture, although the rains are problematic depending upon where the intertropical convergence zone reaches or doesn't reach that particular year. The fact that there are pigs, of course, is a further proof that these are not Muslim people by tradition, because they were between the spheres of Christianity and Islam. The Sudanic crops, especially millet and sesame, zayd simsim, or sesame for making other foods. These are not people who have kingdoms or states, never in their history. But the best you would find in terms of traditional political organization is the position of mek, or like village headman or chief, something like that, as well as other people of giving legitimacy to kujar and rainmakers and so forth, who are brought into the society to interface between, you know, prosaic normal needs and the religion of the wider world. The Bareda, the councils of elders, is homologous to Arabic Majlis al-Shuyukh, something like that. But it's a much more egalitarian society, much more small-scale society than any of the ancient Sudanic states like Darfur or Sfunj or some of these other cases. So if you were in the neighborhood and you saw these ladies walking by, in case you're not familiar, I'm sure you know about Dura, but other people may never have seen Dura, but it's the staple grain for the region. They have a very active, let's call it social life, with a lot of role for joking and storytelling and the music, especially if you can drink some marisa. Probably marisa is an ancient Meroitic word, suggesting that they're coming from the north, in fact, at some earlier time. And kaduma is extremely important. You can't get more important than Nuba wrestling. And it goes on until today, especially as a spectator sport, even in Khartoum. If you would like to see Nuba wrestlers, go to Khartoum. You don't have to go to Nuba Mountains. And these wrestlers are pretty serious guys. I think I don't want to fight with him myself. He's a rough customer. And there are some of the most celebrated people. It's like a sports figure. I mean, let's take your best football player. This would be the equivalent for the Nuba wrestlers. And highly revered. Art and architecture. Again, I won't take too much time on that, except to say that there is all kind of cosmetics and tattooing and cicatrice and so forth. I'll show you a few of those. The cattle horn deformation, I just put that in because it also ties the Nuba people to the far north. So there's some of the famed body painting for, you know, special occasions. And then use of these cattle horns. This would be in not so much today, some places for folkloric activities, but it's traditional, you know, value. Now, medieval Christianity that we'll hear about entered Nubia, but never entered, until colonial times. It never entered the Nuba Mountains. So there were Christianity in Sudan for longer than has been Muslim, as a matter of fact. And when Islam came, you can see it never reached the Nuba Mountain people. So they were isolated again by the main thrust of religious groups, Islam or Christianity. They were retreating and marginalized by preference, you could say, as an assertive objective. So this is some of the basic background. Well, here we have Nil al-Masr, Nile of Egypt, which also escaped them. And over here is Sudan. So we have the Nile of Sudan on the other side, which is basically the Niger River. So that's a little bit of orientation cartography. Now, speeding along, We have a couple of, I'm trying to go back a little bit, go back to the Nimeiri period from 69. I was actually an employee of the Nimeiri government and worked in the Ministry of Southern Affairs at the time of the Regional Autonomy Accord. So I have a lot of, that's why I went to Nuba Mountains, actually. And Nimeiri actually needs a little bit of pause here because there were three Nimeiris. There was the socialist Nimeiri, there was the capitalist Nimeiri, and there was the Islamist Nimeiri. And in the last phase, as each of these periods of Nimeiri evolved rapidly, in the last phase, it was he who introduced the September laws, or where the Hadud, or Islamic, harsh Islamic measures, were introduced. As much as someone may love or hate Omar Bashir, he didn't start this. This came with Nimeiri, and with Nimeiri's chief number one sidekick, Hassan al-Tarabi, who has been in and out of the situation in Sudan for a long time. It was a consequence, this is a very important point, of those September laws that the war started or restarted, because we already had the Anyanya War from 55 to 71. And this is restarting the war, but it's a very different kind of war, because the objective of Anyanya and to some extent the values that would be held within Nuba Mountains was secession. And they failed. They got regional autonomy. The objective of SPLA has been to have a transformed, unified Sudan, and they may, in fact, end up with secession. So this is a very strange type of situation. Anyway, Nimeiri was toppled. Briefly, we had 1 year of Sawara Dahab, transitional military government, and then Sadiq al-Mahdi came to power, the grandson of the famous Mahdi Muntazir, and he was not able to escape this September loss. The pressure was on him, would you please get rid of this, and then we can have a unitary Sudan. He didn't have the political capital or imagination to resolve that. And so, in fact, it's alleged that the night before he was overthrown, he was maybe going to finally address this problem, but he never could do that. And so then we start with the Omar Hassan al-Bashir government where we have today. So that is very important background to have in mind. Now, within all of this time, we have a number of leaders in the Nuba Mountains. Most prominent of all is Philip Gabush, Episcopal minister, priest, and also social political activist for a very, very long period of time. He created the General Union of Nubas, the very militant, the GUN, you know, to make it more aggressive or something, and the Free Negroes Organization, later on transformed United Front for the Liberation of African Sudan, emphasizing the African cultural side. And his he's been having a lot of troubles with the government. Now, the time of tensions really gets going as the SPLA, Sudan People's Liberation Army, gets really moving in a more military form, with Yusuf Kuwa going to up into Nuba Mountains to try to expand, move the struggle in the south from the three southern provinces to push it up into the Nuba Mountains and end all of the grievances, many grievances, marginalization, oppression, and all the Arab domination from a cultural, linguistic, and religious point of view that they had. Even for the east, we have some problems with Beni Amr and Nuba in Port Sudan, protested by Gabush. So off we go, war. I'll go quickly on this. By 87, the Volcano Battalion is moving into Nuba Mountains and really starting to threaten Khartoum from a military point of view. 88, more clashes with the PDF or Murakhalin, this informal militias as a branch of the Khartoum government. By this time, already 50,000 are displaced, either spontaneous displaced or displaced by a policy of the government to separate the people from the armed forces. The new Kush, tying again back to Nubia, to the far north, SPLA idea to reform, transform the Sudan to something new and different, secular, democratic, and so forth. is getting more and more intensified. Oh, 2 minutes. Okay, I'll go really fast. Well, we'll just go into some of these points. Bottom line here, when elephants fight, the grass is trampled. The elephants being the SPLA and the government of Sudan, the grass, of course, Nuba people. Time of war, I will just go very quickly. This is going on as the Omar Bashir government actually declares, especially pushed by Tarabi, jihad against Nuba people and so forth. So here we are, SPLA fighters moving in to engage the north in the southern part of the north. And the battle is continuing. Basically, the middle roaders in the Nuba Mountains get hit by traffic in both directions, and it's a human rights catastrophe, civil rights, every other kind of rights. This little summary diagram, we can come back to this. Here's Nuba Mountains between the Arab Liberation Front and Misriya and Baggara people in general, and Ngok Dinka immediately in the northern part of southern. So there's a graphic description of the kind of situation that they're in. So you can read this grim news as it pops on the screen and as I'm exhausting my little minute left. SPLA is now very actively challenging. This is a drawing, not a traditional drawing, but a Nuba person with the machine gun or SPLA person shooting down Sudanese aircraft in the form of some terrible thing, crashing down with the Antonovs. And again, you can read faster than I can talk. And so here we have the human rights tragedy with deliberately displacing and spontaneously displacing the people of the Nuba Mountains, basically like the South had been before or as Darfur is today. I mean, same kind of idea. So we'll speed along with now almost into maybe 1 minute. And you can see the situation with relief planes coming into the Nuba Mountains to try to address the human rights, health needs, water needs, education needs, civilian needs, and so forth. And, of course, we have a very heavily mined area from both sides and a time where we hope, in my last 30 seconds, to try to get joint integrated units of SPLA and GOS, Government of Sudan, within UN mission in Sudan to separate the forces. It's sort of working fairly well. I mean, relative to generally how badly things are working, it's working fairly well. And so we're trying to go forward to 2009. Possibilities is of peace, but Abyei and Blue Nile province, despite the agreement which just got made, is very problematic. And for Nuba Mountains, it's only consultation and non-binding. So it's an explosive mixture ready to blow up more or less at any time. The election already we'll hear about postponed, and elections in that neck of the woods are always problematic, no matter what the result will be. The census and the referendum, the 700-pound gorilla for Sudan, the referendum, and the tensions are high. They're both sides are rearming. Chinese tanks are, aircraft coming in. The SPLA is getting more and more tanks. And, of course, we have the issue of oil, and the oil pipeline goes right through Nuba Mountains. So something more to fight about in that respect. There is mine clearing, and then I think we have here one of the commanding officers of the Joint Integrated Units to try to keep these people apart. And then that's my little commercial message. Why don't you join the Sudan Studies Association? Come on, join it. Thank you, USIP. Thank you, audience. And I think I could go way slower, and we'll do that later. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. I will now turn it over to Nuruddin Abdulmanan.
How can I turn on my...
Okay, well, can you...
You want to push... I should push these for you? Or I don't know what the technology part here... Mm-hmm. Smack.
Okay.
It's in the computer already. But you need to close mine and find his.
Okay.
Maybe it's this one.
This one, yeah.
It's saved.
It's already stolen from you, never to see it again. Nothing.
Bigger. Okay, that's good. Good evening. I would like to thank USIP for this second time to inviting me to this great forum. But this is the first time for me to talk about Nubia. I've been talking about Sudan human rights and the marginalized groups and so on for the last 20 years. Nubia was just in the back burner because it wasn't a hot issue at that time. The issue of Nubia came to the front after the dams issue was raised by the government of Sudan, the National Islamic Front. They started talking about building dams in northern Sudan in 1995 or 1996. And the Nubians started opposing building dams because they had a very bitter experience in the early 60s when the High Dam of Egypt was built and a big part of Nubia was flooded and inundated. So I will concentrate on the problems facing Nubians now. Professor Richard spoke about the historical background briefly, but Nubia in history, most of the Sudan was Nubia from south of Khartoum, where the last Nubian Christian kingdom was seated in Soba. And the Arabs and the Funj, or the Africans, overran it in 1505, just 500 years ago, and destroyed the last Nubian Christian kingdom over there. And from that time, Nubians lost their power, and they were gradually assimilated into the Arabic culture and they got also Islamicized. They were converted to Islam. I'm talking about the Nubians in the north. So the name of Nubia is derived from Nab, which is a hieroglyphic name for gold. And Nubia was called the land of gold. And there are still some traces of mines south of Wadi Halfa and also in close to Khartoum areas also. So the Nubians ruled almost all nowadays Sudan and Egypt during the 25th dynasty. That was when Taharqa Pei, his father, and Taharqa and Kishta were the pharaohs mentioned in the Old Testament also, in more than 50 or 56 verses in the Old Testament. Taharqa's story and his military expedition to Jerusalem was mentioned in 701 BC, just 3,000 years ago. He led an army, very huge army, from Merwe and from Egypt, and went to that part of the world to repel the Assyrian annihilation to the Jewish kingdom over there. This is briefly about the Nubian history. Now they are helpless, defenseless. They are subjugated, almost Arabized. There is a very big cultural cleansing taking place in the area. Nubians are severely marginalized, isolated. Millions of Nubians deserted, or actually they were forced to go out of their lands, not only because of the dams, but because of the isolation from the Arabs in the north, in Egypt, and also the Arabized Nubians in the south. Now we find approximately 1 million Nubians in the Arabian Gulf working as in menial works, and mostly, and there are also many professionals, but they were the first to migrate to Saudi Arabia and the Gulf, and even the first immigrants to the Western Hemisphere were Nubians. So Nubia is facing a very grave situation because of this isolation imposed on them from the Arabs. The Arabic media is the only media available in the area. They are not even allowed to talk or use their language in the schools. It's prohibited. And we are not allowed as Nubians to teach Nubian language in the schools. It's not included in the curriculum. So recently, back in 1997, an Egyptian archaeologist authored a Nubian book after it was abandoned over 700 to 800 years, just like the Hebrew language. He brought it back to life, and we started teaching this language to our younger generation. And also we are trying to start classes here in the States. Already a class has been opened in Canada. Along with our efforts in educating the people about Nubia and its culture and history and so on, we are trying to tell the people that this land is subjected to destruction, total destruction, because the government of Sudan is building a series of dams. They are actually in the process of building a dam in Kajbar and one north of it in Dal, just at the southern tip of the High Dam. And they already finished building a dam in Merwe. It's a very historical, very important historical site, very close to the pyramids of the Nubian kings over there. And by the way, there are more than 20 pyramids in Sudan. We have only 3 in Egypt. And the only 25th dynasty of Taharqa is mentioned in the Taharqa and Pei is mentioned in the Egyptian history. But the Nubians, they have still their language, their culture, their traditions, and they are still living. If you go to Egypt, you don't find a single hieroglyphic word. The language of more than 30 dynasties, or more than 30, I think, pharaohs or dynasties. Egyptians are 100% Arabized, but they are still talking about their pharaohs, but they don't want the Nubians to talk about their history. when Nubians talk about even uniting the Nubians between Nubians in Egypt and Sudan, it's a racist or against the unity of Egypt or the integrity of or sovereignty of Egypt and Sudan. While they, it's permissible for them to talk about unity between the Arab nations from Syria or from Syria to Morocco or Mauritania. But for Nubians, it's not allowed. In Egypt, if you go, you don't find ministers or diplomats or senior officials from Nubia. You don't find even broadcasters or in the TV or in Sudan. Also, they started eliminating Nubians from the civil service. I was one of them. Many Nubians were purged from the civil service back in 1989 when the Islamist government came to power in Sudan. And these are some of beautiful golden works in Nubia thousands of years ago. All these beautiful artifacts were destroyed, and many historical sites will be inundated, and very important historical treasures will be gone forever if these dams are built over there. This is why we are telling the international community, UNESCO and the United Nations, that if you don't come to help salvaging these historical sites and so on, they will be gone forever. They will be flooded. You cannot get them back from water, just as it happened in the 60s when the high dam was built. So the total Nubian area will be flooded from the border with Egypt to very close to Khartoum. And this is what some Egyptians want, because they don't want any competition or any dollar to seep or infiltrate into Sudan. They want the tourists come just to Aswan and fly back to Europe. Nubia is suffocated by the Egyptians and the Arabs of Sudan. And we are also alerting or telling the world that if you don't come to help us, to help the Nubians, Arabs started buying the lands along the Nile Valley. The billionaires and even the Arab states started buying huge estates along the Nile. And they are about to build a very big empire, a formidable one. An Islamo-Arabic state is taking shape. They are going to wipe out these indigenous people. And they are going to bring all these trillions of dollars in the Gulf, the petrodollar money, to the Nile Valley, just across the Red Sea, with the Egyptian manpower, as if Nubia is a no man's land. We were depopulated or marginalized or pushed out of our land because there was no any services. The government was depriving the Nubians from even opening it for the international tourism or businesses and so on. So what we need from you is to help us stop damning Nubia, and also join our campaigns to tell the international community, through your Congress members, through your community centers, synagogues, churches, mosques, everywhere, tell them that there is a very important land where you share them history, and an international heritage will be gone forever. If you don't come now, they are going to build their own empire over there, and they will challenge the Western democracy. Now they started even penetrating into Nubia, in Egypt and in Sudan. Many of them started turning into being fanatic or they started embracing these fanatic ideas and so on. And they say that we are Muslims and so on. No, it's not a problem to be a Muslim. Indonesians are Muslims, but they are not Arabs. But in Sudan and in Egypt, they claim to be Arabs. And this is why we are begging the academicians, please accept our proposal to consider Nubian language as a part of your curriculum. We want to educate the people. And if you want to know Egypt and Sudan, learn Nubian language and study Nubian history. Without this, this is the key, the golden key to know the area. And we encourage also the Congress members not to look at Sudan from an Egyptian goggle. You send your delegations over there, fact-finding missions to go there. Nubians are dying by cancers. The 50,000 Nubians who were relocated in New Halfa in eastern Sudan, they are living under asbestos-roofed houses. 50,000 people who were relocated 45 years ago, they are approaching 1 million. They are not increasing area-wise, but the population is increasing and they spill over in Khartoum and in the Gulf and so on. And this is also an appeal to all of you to tell the world, your Congress members and the State Department and all organizations, that the cancer is spreading. It's becoming epidemic among the Nubians in eastern Sudan and strangely also in northern Sudan. I don't know what's happening over there also. Either they get contracted from eastern Sudan, but Nubians are subjected to elimination and they will be wiped out. I hope my time is over and we'll get more opportunity later on. Thank you very much, and I give the floor to my colleague Omar.
Thank you.
Thank you very much,
thank you, USIP, and thank you, the citizen of the United States of America. Thank you, all the audience here and my panel group here. In fact, this is one of the most important chances to educate people about our problems in Sudan, and I hope that you will be patient to listen to our complaints, because this is the only window we have now. In eastern Sudan, I will be brief to talk about three major issues, which is economy, services, includes education and health, and then I will go to security. The Bija people have been in eastern Sudan for thousands of years, as well as the Nubians. We have been maybe 5,000-6,000 years over there. We have been participating in Sudan history through the years, defending what we claim our country, and participating in each activity took place in Sudan. We were the gatekeepers for Nubians' kingdoms, and all the kingdoms of the Nile through many years. And at the end, when the independence happened, people felt they are marginalized and they treated unfairly. 1958, after the independence, when people go through the sharing of power and wealth, the eastern Sudan was marginalized completely, and the Bija people felt they were treated unfairly. So they tried to form a community that is, in the beginning it was not a political community, it was just for raising the awareness of the unfairness that they have been received. But Of course, politics goes over everything and spill to everything. And they felt that they have to go through a political party that will bring their needs to the awareness. In 1958, they formed the Bija Congress Party. Unfortunately, before it practiced any activity, November 1958, a coup through the elected government, and of course, every activities, democratic activities, was postponed. 1964, when that governor was thrown by the people, again, they went back to participate in the political life and democratic life of Sudan, and they were able to have 11 elected people in the parliament of Sudan, which is more than many parties like the Communist Party and the Islamic Party. These were in the minorities, and the Bija Congress was not in the majority, but was a considerable party in the parliament. Unfortunately, like many years, another coup through the elected government, and Nimeiri was in power for 16 years. Then the story repeated another revolution through that dictator, and people started again to participate in the democratic life and social and political life, and they have representative until 1989, when another general jumped on the tank and threw the elected government, and I think he's still there. The main issues of the people of the Bija is that they have a severe, harsh environment, especially in the Red Sea. And if I go back to show where the Bija lives, they live in the eastern Sudan. Thank you. This area. Covered all this area, which is in the north with Egypt, and in the south and east with Ethiopia and Eritrea, and they go very close to the Nile, where they have established some kingdoms in the past. Now, the most important complaints I have is that these people have been marginalized through several years. And to be fair, it is not only this government, but all the governments who came to the power in Sudan, they neglected the life of these people. And I believe that if someone wake up from the even before 1,000 years, he will join life without being surprised. The people who live in this area, I said, they're the Bija. There are also many tribes, many other tribes, which is whom they share the land with them. But mainly the major inhabitants of the Red Sea and Kassala and Gadarif, these are the Bija people. Regardless of the resources, wealth resources, they have agriculture projects. They have oil, gold, manganese, and marble, iron, so many resources. Regardless of all these wealth, the people live in poverty. Bija people live in poverty, an unexplained one, because they are deprived from having their chance to participate in jobs, to share the wealth that their land give. For now, the main problem is that they have been run out of resources because the harsh climate have participated together with the government to deprive them from living a decent life or normal life. They lost their cattle, they lost their agricultural projects. Unfortunately, the government also helped in this by depriving them from jobs in the rural areas or urban areas. The people are facing real threat of dying, of losing their lives, because not only the government is not helping them, but also it is stopping other people to help them, other organizations which are designed to help in these situations. They are prohibited from coming to Eastern Sudan, and in the name of sovereignty and in the name of self-sufficient and things like that, they have been stopped from helping the Eastern Sudan people, and we are in real crisis that they might be wiped out. I don't know if this is the goal of the government, but this is what is going to happen, because people are dying in numbers. They are dying through health crisis. They are starving, and no any kind of help is open to them or is allowed to come to them. For also in the field of education, because they speak another language, not Arabic, they are facing the difficulty in achieving in achieving any kind of good standard educations. The few of them who succeed to go through the system, they are also by means of alienating them from their people and drive them from the jobs. Some of them, they immigrate outside. Security, this is the last point I will touch. Security also, the case, there is not that much the government is doing to help people bringing people together. Of course, in this harsh climate, no freedom, poverty, and also people not educated, things will sometimes go out of hand, and people try to solve their problems by themselves since the government is not participating. And what we hear that the government also is trying to ignite some of these conflicts, and I don't know if this is this is the way they want to continue governing the area or Sudan as general, or is it just something for political gains they want to achieve? My concern is that you can start these things, but it is very tough to stop them. If you start these things, they will go on, and they will go out of control, and that we have, of course, so many examples in South Sudan, in Darfur, in Nubia Mountain, even all over the place. And I don't know if the skill of the government is just to ignite conflicts between people. I just ask them to try another way. Why don't they try to bring people together? This is a very huge country. It is the size of, I believe, the south of the United States of America. This is rich of resources, rich of culture differences, and we will be proud, Sudanese will be proud to be together And with all these differences, still they can live, they can share, and they can prosper. And I hope everyone and each one of you will help us to spread the message that the people of Sudan, they need the help. In Eastern Sudan or everywhere, they need the help to stop conflicts and from erupting in their areas. They need the help to get an equal share from their resources. And I believe I don't remember exactly the words, but Roosevelt said that he will see someday people will achieve better peace than governments. And thank you very much for listening. Thank you.
Thank you. We have about a half an hour for questions. So if you could just identify yourself before you ask your question, the floor is open. Yes, sir.
Thank you. My name is Ahmed Abouzeid.
Could you speak up? I think they need to hear you more in the back.
Some sort of misinterpretation of history and of the factual events in history. I think we need to differentiate between two levels of interpretation. The first level is talking about the heritage and culture that we need to preserve, that we need to put resources and mobilize resources, international resources, to preserve and to admit that this culture exists, this language exists, and we need to keep it and rescue it if there is any kind of danger. And another level of analysis in which we mix parts, we mix talking about the cultural civilization and ethnic cleansing, political marginalization, acts that are done by governments, either in Sudan or Egypt, against specific ethnicity, which I don't think is the case when it comes to the new. In fact, some of the comments today were talking about Egyptian history and trying to undermine the role of the Union participation in it, although I advise maybe some of you who have the opportunity to visit the Egyptian Museum in Cairo would see very clearly that there is clear explanation of the Nubian culture and the Nubian participation in building this history and making the Egyptian the pharaohs, the Egyptian ancient history. And when it comes to projects, big projects, national projects like the High Dam, like some of the dams in Sudan, like Tikba or Marawi, these are national projects that aim to counter marginalization. These are projects that aim to bring water to areas, to cultivation, to land reclamation. And there was specific decrees by the government of Sudan and by the government of Egypt during the High Dam establishment that were intended to compensate any of the inhabitants of such areas, namely the PRD. Nubians, if they are living in Cairo, if they are living in any area in which this project occurs.
I'm sorry, sir, just in the interest of time, maybe we could get to the question or
well,
the
this is,
main
this
comment.
Is a comment. It is not a question. And it's meant to say that there was a specific decree by the government of Egypt to give ownership of the land just a year ago by the President Mubarak to give ownership of the land for the Nubians, where the areas were affected by this, by the Haida, for example. Also, the Egyptians participate right now with over 5,000 of its boys, Egyptian boys, in the Nuba Mountains, in Kadubli, in the Nuba Mountains, to help and to protect the Sudanese brothers living there in this area. So I think there was a lot of misinterpretation in some of the comments today, and maybe you will have the opportunity to submit to the EU some papers on what the Egyptian government is doing to help the Nubians, whom we see as Egyptians living in Egypt, where we have over 5 million Sudanese. We don't differentiate between who is Nubian and who is not Nubian.
Thank you. I'm going to take three at a time. Sir, okay. Go ahead.
All right. My question is primarily for Mr. Ahmed Chini.
I'm sorry, if you could just identify yourself.
Yeah, my name is Ahmed Kududa, and I'm a student. I can't help but notice that the struggle of the Nubians and the Bijan people is almost identical to that of South Sudan, to that of the Darfuris, of the Nuba Mountains. And the question is, it is a struggle of Sudanese people to assert themselves as equals amongst others in the view of perhaps Dr. Ben, of a united Sudan for all Sudanese. And my question is, do your peoples have any plans to unite or create some sort of umbrella organization? Because you have the Bija Congress for the Bija people, you have the Nubia Project for the Nubia people, you have the SPLM for the Southerners. Is there a plan to create some sort of umbrella organization to bring Sudanese as equals under one banner to tell this government that we're no longer going to be divided under ideological lines, under divide and conquer strategies? We're not going to fall for that. And what are your plans to essentially move forward, especially with the elections and with the referendum coming up? Is there going to be a unified front, or are you going to engage in the elections?
Okay, let me just take two more questions, sir. And Khalid. Next round, we'll...
Thank you. My name is Salah, I'm from Nubia, Sudan. I try to find common ground with Nuruddin. But I think, unfortunately, I couldn't find anything that I agree with him. Starting from the beginning, that destruction of the Christian kingdoms in Sudan, this is not destruction. This is quite natural. It's a natural development of history. We cannot say that these kingdoms have been destroyed by Islam. I mean, if you start with destruction and policies of a series of conspiracy, through this prism, you can see everything there. I cannot also agree with destruction with dance. I cannot imagine how dance can destruct population or whatever it is. What we are having in Sudan is we have so many problems in the east, in the west, in central Sudan, even if you go outside 100 kilometers from Khartoum, you find problems. There are problems. We have to deal with them. We are trying to deal with them. Government are not sufficient in dealing with this crisis, but we, the Sudanese people, should take our fate in our hands and try to solve our problems. The second is about Nubians. I'm a Sudanese. I've been there, been in the foreign service. This colleague of yours, Dean, has not been because of his Nubian. No, there are so many Sudanese who have been out of service, not because they are Nubians. So many other things. For so many reasons, you might know, I might know, and others might not know. Concerning their plight to the Gulf, I mean, how many Sudanese are, not from the west, from the east, even from the south, they have been going to the Gulf. This is an economic, economic strike for them. Those are not exports from Sudan. Concerning the dam marine, which is a very, very huge project in Sudan. It almost doubles the production of electricity. It's almost the total area of irrigation now in Sudan. It's 2 million fadams. How can I say this is a project for destruction? I'm speaking about marginalization. Marginalization could be because of place, it could be because of economic consequences, because it could be because of lack of participation. But I cannot, I'm marginalized, and at the same time, I stay here in Washington, D.C., and you're speaking about dams are destruction, the people there. If their life now is not destruction, and the dam is going to worsen the situation, nobody can, in his prime or his logic, can understand such a way. Investment in Sudan, we have so many resources. We lack investment. We're glad to have other brothers from Egypt, from other Gulf states. We are calling them to come and to invest in Sudan, so that we can alleviate the situation of economic deprivation in Sudan. Any project in Sudan, be it in agriculture or be it in any type of investment, is going to, they are not going to take the land, you say. The land is there. It's the Sudanese land, is going to be invested for the benefit of the country, with their help, with their financial assistance of financial investment. To our colleagues from the east, this is what the government is trying to do. There are problems in the east as well as in other parts of Sudan. I say that there are problems, there are chronic problems. They are not for this government. We have inherited them from the independence. There are problems. What the East Peace Agreement is about is a strive from the government, strive from people from the east to address these problems. There are problems in the east. This is why we have the East Agreement. It is for this type of thing. We cannot say that people from America or from any else in the world are going to solve our problems. We have to solve our problems. We have to find amicable ways to politically sit together, negotiate the problems, sort them out, and try to find ways to help them. Professor Luban had spoke about history of before this signing of the CPO. The situation now has changed after CPO. Mountains, especially in the mountains area, with the new administration. Yusuf Kubua was a colleague of mine in the university, who had been in the same class, Faculty of Economics, who had been there. They have problems in the northern mountains as well as in the north, in the east, in the middle, in everywhere. We are living, personally, I'm living 100 kilometers from south of Khartoum. We have problems. In our area, we have problems. Even if you cross out from Khartoum, several kilometers, you will find problems. Coming, enumerating problems and trying to portray them as if they are just huge and big is not going to solve them. We can sit together, we can solve problems, we can find investment, we can build dams, we can raise the living of the standards of the people there so that they can be of a better situation. But you stay here in Washington, D.C., and you are trying to deprive your people there from a dam that is going to generate electricity, that is going to irrigate their land in Sudan. Is this not a help? Personally, I think it's not a help.
Okay, sir, and then.
My name is Ibrahim Ahmed, Vijay Congress, Eastern Sudan. I want to add some ideas about my colleague Omar. I want to mention two issues of peace agreement in the East and the occupation of Halab Triangle by Egyptian government. The Eastern Sudan peace agreement, it is a security agreement between government of Sudan and government of Libya. So please don't think this is peace agreement. This is well known that is thread between the government of Eritrea and government of Sudan. The next thing regarding the Halab Triangle, the Halab Triangle is a bigger land. It is not being one day Egyptian land. And the Bija is not an Egyptian tribe. So I'm asking the Egypt embassy why you harm Bija people in their homeland and why you restrict their movement and why you mistreat Bija people.
Okay. One more question, and I'll turn it over to you.
My name is Kabir Shahrukh from Noor and Nubian. I'm not a Asbeliyah. Actually, I just mentioned to the history. Suffering in the Nubian for generally Sudan, for Kuflan, for beginning, when Arab come bring the Islam to us. They started destroying our villages to the Nubian. This is a history. They're destroying us. And there is the Bakht Agreement 1 and 2. You can read that and see what Arab and Muslim did to us, companion of Prophet Muhammad, what they did to us. This first. And all the problem come from Egypt to Sudan. After independence, 2 years, they make coup to change the agreement of the water. After that, also, they bring in America. When Sudan people, they support them when they fight in Israel at that time. In 1976, all Sudan stopped beside the Egypt. After that, what they did to us, they bring coup also, Arabic and communist coup by Nimeri, Jafar Nimeri. Always, they don't need democracy, they need our resources. This is our enemy. All the problem in Sudan from Egypt. It was Mubarak himself, he had aircraft. To bomb the Sudan in 1970. People know that, also know that. Never Egypt, you see the Egypt, they have inside media and outside media. They never see the truth. Only they are liars. I salute our people in Bija. I grew up 20 years in Egypt, in Bija area. And I see it by myself in 1984, the people. The Bija people, they died in the street. When you go to the highway, to the east of Sudan, you see the people died on the animal. Nobody, no any government care of the Bija, because they are not Arab. The same thing to us in Nubia. You see, 20 years, they're killing the people. How many people been killed under this regime? How can you trust these people? They are criminals, they are killers, they are terrorists. If here you read Sudanese online, they said they want to make Islamic State here in America. Yeah, you can go to the newspaper and read Sudanese online. They said you want to make America also, they have to be Muslim, they said. You can go today, you can read the Sudanese newspaper. They said you want to make state here. 99% of the mosque in this country is creating terrorism. From Texas, from Florida, from until Buffalo, everywhere you see Friday prayer, what they are talking about. They don't give us or give the people the good thing, how you believe in God. But they're creating terrorists. And thank you very much.
Okay. I don't know who wants to. I will answer. Thank you. For the comment of. the for the having an umbrella for the marginalized forces forum. We have a marginalized forces forum. It is a civil movement, and we have Voices of Sudan. It is another civil movements under all this. We are working together, trying to achieve a kind of unity between us. Personally, I don't think our goal is elections, and we want to win the elections. We want our message to go to the government of Sudan, and we want our message to go to the people of Sudan. That is, if we want to live together, if we want to have a prosper country, we should work together. Without alienating anybody, without trying to push side anybody, and we will have an equal share as citizens for all of us. I'm sorry for the embassy representative. He said that why are we discussing our problems here? It is a very simple answer, because we were not allowed to do that back home. And if that is the case, if we are allowed to talk freely and to exchange our ideas in Sudan, we will not talk thousands of miles here sitting between us, also other communities that is trying to help us achieve our goals. And if there is an advice, please try to approach the problems of Sudan in different way. We have been, the government of Sudan, not this government also, to be fair, another government, other governments have been killing everyone who objects, anyone who raises his finger, trying to kill them, trying to jail them, trying to push them out. And if we have freedom to talk and freedom to exchange our ideas, we will not travel so many miles to speak about our problems and to expose, as you mentioned, our things outside Sudan. And I hope this will be a new approach, and then you will see the change.
Okay.
Well, okay, this is another issue that I'm sorry, because I have I was considering the time issue, and this is the way when people stand up and try to talk. A very peaceful march was in January 2005 to go and to hand over a letter for their needs to the governor of the Red Sea, state. These people were faced by military people shooting at them. Regardless, they were not armed. They know that it was a peaceful, but they want to teach people a lesson that if you raise your finger, you will cut your head. And this is the message they sent, and 21 people were slaughtered in a very brutal way. Others were wounded. We believe that some others were died before reaching hospitals or because of their wounds, hiding from the security forces, afraid that they might harm their families and things like that. This is of kind of practices we are trying to avoid. Now, please, for everyone, if that is a normal practice for a government to shoot at ordinary people who peacefully want to hand over their needs to the governor to talk about their... in regard of resources, why are we saying that is we have unequal shares? Because you see in Ariab, this is one of the cities in Sudan, or a small town it is, there is a gold mine which is produced to the government of Sudan. This is also an elderly accounts, 5 ton per year. The people of this area tried to have a share with this, and they were told, no, this is the gold of the government of Sudan, and you don't have anything in it. In some cases, they were deprived from their jobs. And the company over there is using cyanide, which is very poisonous chemical, to clear the gold. And people now are experiencing new illnesses they have never heard about it. Cancer, it was not something that you can mention that part of the world, and people can understand what cancer is. They have never had things like that. Water resources, because cyanide stays inside the ground and also poisons the resources of water, so animals and people are hurt by these practices. And now there is some kind of activities going on the Red Sea shore, long from Halaib to the border of Eritrea. This is for oil and gas, and the people, they know that, and they are afraid, because now each time a type of resources is coming, they are hurt by that. They are the first ones to get hurt by these things, because they will be removed from their places. They will not get any kind of benefits. Instead, they are harmed with that. if there is any thing to do with this, also we address the representative of the embassy. Please go and research these things. Find out. Give us answers that give us some kind of guarantees that people, at least they will not get hurt. They have a share. They should have a share. They are poor, but this is their resources. In other parts, the government of Sudan agree to share the resources with the people because they are powerful. Why doesn't it happen here? And we don't need to go in violence, and we need to go in conflicts. Simply. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I could add some. I mean, on one hand, wisdom says I should say nothing because there are antagonistic positions. But my passion for Sudan, I've been going to Sudan for almost 40 years, so I have to say something. What to say about this very contentious problem of many aspects and many dimensions? On one hand, I'll make some political points, some military aspect of this. The various marginalized people, and you could get to put in some Egyptian ones too, if you like, put in Copts or people in Siwa, or, you know, different Bedouin, or Ayashaks, and it is possible to put them into the equation. And there are many more in Sudan that could be put into the equation. They have a strong inability to think beyond their local situation. And so this is a criticism to my friends. You must think beyond your local situation and see the universalistic aspects. There was a direction with the National Democratic Alliance to go in that direction. And to be candid, I was very optimistic, and it's failed. It has no more life at this point. So the marginalized people must think beyond the provincial and parochial aspects of their genuine grievances. The governments of the region, which can include Asmara, Addis, Cairo, and Khartoum, they are autocratic regimes. They are very problematic, dysfunctional regimes. And if they want to go beyond this endless hemorrhages and political pariah status, they have to escape this political prison that they have put themselves in. Because I'm coming now from a military school, I'm thinking about it from a military point of view, the same thing. What has all this insurgency, whether Beja Congress, whether SPLA, whether JEM and SLA and all the other, Jamaa Islamiyah and Osama bin Laden and anyone, what have they really actually managed to accomplish except destroying the people they're seeking to represent? Nothing. On the other hand, what has all the counterinsurgency of the governments, the autocratic governments, what have they really managed to do for 50 years? Except to antagonize the people, have brain drains. So we have a perfect storm here of two irreconcilable positions that are wed to go nowhere. So this is my plight. From my mind says I shouldn't say this much. My heart says I have to say at least this. There is a struggle here. The elephants are fighting. The grass is trampled. And this is not a good situation. I'm speaking here at the U.S. Institute of Peace, from the Naval War College, so we have to make neutral ground, peace and war. We can come together. We can find the middle way if there is intelligent leadership at the marginal areas and at the central governments. So far, they are in this paralytic dance of death.
Back to Nubia. I want to respond to our friend from Egypt, the diplomat. There is a real problem in Nubia. Egypt, when they built the high dam 45 years ago, Nubians sacrificed their land and to the prosperity of Egypt. We gave life to Egypt, but you gave us death and destruction. This is unfortunate. Egypt is storing its waters on the Nubian land for free for the last 45 years. Why for? can you keep your briefcase in your neighbor house for 45 days, not 45 years? We are going to make an arbitration and ask for the demurrage and compensation for the Nubians for this destruction. It's an everlasting destruction. And now they are trying to expand this destruction to cover the whole Nubian land. And as our colleague, the diplomat from Sudan Embassy, said, these dams are not for development. I'll tell you why. Because these waters are not for Sudan usage. The whole water is going to be for Egypt, stored on the Nubian land. Again, they are expanding the storage on the Nubian land for the Egyptian water. And we have documents, videotaped, texts, audio, showing that Sudan is not entitled to take an 1 gallon of water from that one. According to the agreement signed between Sudan and Egypt in 1959, and also a very dangerous agreement signed back in 2004 called the Four Freedoms Act, which gives the right for millions of Egyptian workers to settle and to own the land for 99 years. That means they can annex Sudan just by this piece of paper, by this Four Freedoms Agreement. Because if they, as they mentioned, some officials, Egyptian officials mentioned that they are bringing 6 million laborers. This is the first batch. And even last week, Omar Bashir, when he visited Egypt, they were insisting that you need to implement this Four Freedoms Agreement as quickly as possible. Bring those millions of Egyptian workers while these Nubians were driven out of their lands. Why don't the Sudanese government bring these Nubians back to their land? And they mentioned that the Merowe Dam is going to solve the problem of electricity and energy in Sudan forever. Why are they building more dams? It's because they want to save the high dam, which is flooded. Actually, it's choked by accumulations of millions of tons of clay and silt behind the reservoir. The high dam capacity or reservoir is diminishing and it became ailing. So they want to make, to siphon these deposits of millions of tons of clay behind the high dam by building series of dams to drift this clay back to Egypt and to rejuvenate the delta, which is almost salinized and the seawater is coming to swallow the whole delta in Egypt. We are not against the Egyptian people. We are sharing the same history, the same area, and so on. Let us make an equitable and a fair kind of living. We want to share all these resources together, but we don't want masters to come and buy the land and throw us in the desert. We don't want to be Bedouins in our land. So the Nubian Museum, which was built in Aswan, Egyptians were insisting that this is Aswan Museum, but the UNESCO said no. This is Nubia Museum, because it's not allowed in the Egyptian curriculum to teach the Nubian history. And the Nubian Museum director, Dr. Osama Abdel Waris, mentioned several times, I met him in Vienna last year, and here in Washington, D.C., he mentioned that there is nothing called Nubian history, Nubian civilization. Nubians are part of Egypt. So with this kind of understanding and interpretation and so on, we want to educate the people and tell them that this history is a Nubian history. And we have Professor Charles Bonnet. He mentioned in the recent discoveries in Kerma that Karma is the oldest town in the history. And the pharaohs who were surfaced just 2 years ago in Karma are also clue to the richness of this land, which is going to be inundated forever. It's an international heritage. If you don't come and help us salvage or protect this heritage, it's going to be disastrous. You are going to lose a very invaluable history. The Nubians who helped or who rescued Jerusalem 3,000 ago, 3,000 years ago, they are helpless and they are waiting for you to come and help them. Just make another international campaign to salvage Nubia, as UNESCO did in 1964, to rescue the remaining part of Nubia, to stop these dams. They are not for development. They are just to move the indigenous people of Nubia from their land. The only non-Arabic body, an exotic body in the Arab land between Egypt and Sudan, will be moved away from that. It's a headache to them. And Nubians are working with other marginalized groups, the Bija and the Four and the Southern Sudan, to fulfill or to bring this new Sudan vision into being. We already started forming this body for the African indigenous groups around. When Abdurrahim Hamdi, the minister of the ex or the former minister of commerce and finance in Sudan, he is one of the elites of the Islamic movement in Sudan. When they failed actually in bringing this Islamic or the civilizational project, as they call it, he minimized their strategy in that small triangle to make it as a launch pad or a springboard to concentrate all the efforts and resources of the Islamists and the Islamic money from Saudi Arabia and from all over the world and so on. And from that they jump all over and create. That's going to be the embryo for the new body or the new Islamo-Arabic body in the area. The Sudan government created another state just to link Khartoum to Cairo, to Egypt, the River Nile state. It was created back in 1995 or 1994 just to split or to make a barrier between the Nubians and the Bija, an Arabic finger or body in the middle. And this triangle will help in attracting all these wealthies of the Arab world with the help of the Chinese imperialism to create a new power in the Nile Valley. And believe me, this is going to happen. As I used to warn just 8 days before the tragic events of September 11 at the State Department. We read between the lines of these terrorists and how they think and how they talk. I told them that these people will hit you here in your heartland. You are not taking issues seriously. Talking about slavery. Slavery is a heinous human practice, but it's not as dangerous like terrorism. And here, you cannot live in darkness for 2 days or 3 days. Over there, they can live forever. They can live without health or without sanitation or food or so on, for just with the minimum requirements. So if these people are able to build that body over there, it's going to be a very, very big nightmare. The democratic world is responsible of helping the marginalized people of Sudan, even the Arabs of Sudan, or the brainwashed Nubians, those who are Arabized, they will also live with the other marginalized groups and so on equal footing. With they are going to share the same resources and so on, but not as masters, no longer. We are the owners of the land, and we will bring all these groups together. We started already doing this. But without your help, and we share the same interests, common interests, we have the same common enemy against democracy, human rights, and so on. So it is also your obligation to help these marginalized groups to win the upcoming election. If they don't win, you will find it very difficult to change the situation. If we are finding difficulty in removing or wiping out these terrorist groups or Osama bin Laden, a stateless small group, how are you going to deal with a very huge empire from Alexandria to the lakes with all these trillions of dollars and man force and with all these resources? The Nubian aquifer, the biggest aquifer or the biggest underground water in the world. When water erupts, war erupts over water resources and so on, this is going to be the last area of drinkable water. So we want you to give some attention to this problem. It's brewing, it's taking shape. Before it becomes a real nightmare, I invite you please to go and read and join us, help us, because this is a common issue. We are facing a common enemy. Thank you.
Okay. We are actually out of time. And I think just from the questions and the responses, you can tell it's an issue that I think probably deserves deeper exploration, and is quite passionately felt. But I do want to thank our panelists, and I want to thank you for coming and for your presentations. Thanks.